is Red Eyes Radio.
Today with me on the line I have Daniel Pinchbeck. He is the author of Breaking Open the Head and his latest book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. I remember first hearing a recording of a lecture that Daniel did at the Burning Man Festival in 2005, so that's about a year ago now, I guess. And I was fascinated with his talk and information. He span over many different areas, including entheogens, shamanism, crop circles, the 2012 date, and many, many other subjects that I've been exploring on the Red Eyes website. So it's going to be great to hear more about Daniel and his book and his research. So, and I can also say that his website, if you want to follow along here during our talk, is breakingopenthehead.com. Just one word, breakingopenthehead.com. So welcome to the program, Daniel, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ah, great, great. You know, why don't we begin at the beginning, and maybe you can, if you want to, tell a little bit about yourself and how you came onto this bumpy road of research area or so.
Yeah, no problem. So, yeah, I'm about 40 years old now. I was born in 1966, and I guess I was a journalist in New York for a number of years, and I was also sort of editing a literary magazine on the side. And I was in my late 20s. I'd been writing for the New York Times Magazine and Esquire and Wired and other publications. And I just began to sort of hit a kind of existential nihilistic crisis, kind of your traditional spiritual crisis. And at that point, I began to just find that the activities that I was engaged in seemed very materialistic and kind of empty. And I was kind of confronted by this sense of, the void, basically. And I sort of went back through I'd grown up as a secular materialist. I mean, my parents were artists. My mother was a writer. My dad was a painter. But I had no kind of spiritual or religious or mystical kind of anything in my upbringing. So at that point, when I hit this crisis, I went back through my life up to that point and tried to figure out if I'd ever encountered, like, anything that seemed like to represent higher consciousness or some other possibility of reality. And I remembered my psychedelic experiences in college. So I decided that I would go back and sort of begin to re-explore psychedelics. And even though they were nothing that they were of no interest to the people in my world at that time, who were sort of heavy drinkers and into cocaine and heroin a little bit, just this decadent literary world, the alternative rock era of Nirvana and Pavement and so on. So I located some mushrooms and LSD and tried them again, and lo and behold, found that they really did seem to suggest these other possibilities of consciousness. At high doses, there would be extraordinary hallucinations and geometric patterns and then the sense of a kind of deeper wisdom or deeper consciousness at work, and a sense of also kind of a deconditioning from the kind of social and cultural reality that everybody accepted as normal.
Yeah.
Kind of a sense that you went back to your kind of original state of being or something. And I got more and more interested, and because I was a journalist, I started to get some assignments. So I took ayahuasca in a ceremony downtown. Do you think that your listeners are familiar with ayahuasca at this point?
Yeah, I think most of them are, so, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I took ayahuasca, and then I got an assignment from a music magazine to take iboga, which is a West African psychedelic, in a tribal initiation ritual down in Gabon, which is on the western equator of West Africa, with a tribe called the Bwiti, who use iboga as their kind of initiation, spark. And that experience was very catalyzing for me. I mean, iboga had been described as 10 years of psychoanalysis in one night, and I thought that was ridiculous. It had to be like a ridiculous exaggeration.
Yeah.
Actually, for me, the experience was a little bit like that. I went through a lot of early childhood memories and saw sort of how I'd been constructed up to that point as a person. And I really felt like there was this almost like guiding intelligence that was taking me through different scenes.
And,
my parents splitting up and illnesses I'd child and fears and drinking and so on. So that, you know, so that was a catalytic experience. Then from there I went to the Amazon, took ayahuasca with shamans in the Amazon and visited the Mazatec Indians in Mexico, visited the Burning Man Festival, explored a lot of synthetic psychedelics, DMT and DPT and 2CB and so on, and ended up kind of moving out of the sort of secular materialist worldview that I've been brought up into a kind of acceptance of shamanism and mysticism and this whole kind of psychic dimension of reality. And it really came out of my experiences, synchronicities, telepathic experiences, foretellings that I had in visions and shamans had, and then also all the anecdotes that I gathered from other people. So that's really what the first book, Breaking Open the Head, kind of chronicled, this shift in worldview for, based on my experience from secular materialism to shamanism. And that led me to this new book, 2012, because I then realized that it was basically like if we'd grown up in this modern Western rational construct where these kind of, you know, esoteric, mystical, and shamanic sort of psychic levels of reality had been denied and systematically repressed to the point where Europe had even, like, killed all the witches and, you know, committed genocide against a lot of indigenous people and so on, then, and if this other form of knowledge had validity, then we had to take seriously, or I felt like I had to take seriously, what these indigenous cultures are saying about the time that we're in now. So that led me to look at the Hopi prophecies and the Mayan prophecies and sort of try to stitch together some kind of sort of philosophical thesis about what's happening in the world now.
Ah, interesting. And there we have the rundown, I think, the complete picture. I mean, let's go into a few other things here because I want to return to the thing you said about communication in regards to entheogens or even DMT, I guess. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, do you think that there's some other intelligence involved here, or is it a part of ourselves, or do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is a brain chemical. It's produced in our pineal gland. It's similar in kind of molecular composition to serotonin and melatonin and so on. But when you synthesize it, I mean, it's also part of the ayahuasca potion and so on. But when you synthesize it and smoke it, it shoots you very, very abruptly, like, out of your body and into this other reality for a period that seems to last from, like, 3 to 7 or 10 minutes. This is NN-DMT. There's two types. There's 5-MeO-DMT and NN-DMT. And I think that if you're able to take back into this reality what that reality is like, it really almost feels like you're entering a kind of a higher dimensional consciousness. That is sort of like, in the first book I kind of described it as, you know, Walt Disney World meets Tibetan mandalas in the 21st century or something. it's like a kind of it's like a next level of sentience or something. And one has the feeling of sort of being confronted by the by these kind of massive guardians or entities, or I did anyway. So what the hell is DMT? You know, I mean, I think there's some interesting theories, and I like this book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. Do you know it?
I've heard of it, yes.
It's by this guy, Rick Strassman, who's a doctor who was the first person since the 60s, I think, to get approval in the U.S. to do a study on human subjects with psychedelic, which was DMT. And so Strassman was a Buddhist, and he had read in Buddhist texts that according to Buddhism, the soul reincarnates 7 weeks after death. And then he discovered that the pineal gland in the human fetus appears 49 days after conception, exactly 7 weeks. So he was wondering if there might be a correlation to this, that in the pineal gland is this kind of singular organ in the brain that Descartes saw as the seat of the soul. It has a lens and a cornea, so it really is kind of an evolutionary third eye. So he began to look at the chemicals that were produced by the pineal gland. I think first he studied melatonin, and his idea was that there might be a chemical there that would actually be the spirit molecule, that if there was somehow, you know, this kind of mechanism of reincarnation, there would have to be a kind of conductive mechanism that brought the spirit, the reincarnating spirit, from kind of the one dimension to this dimension, the higher dimension. So he ended up offering the thesis that DMT was this kind of conductive medium. And I think it's quite possible this is the case.
Interesting. And do you think, you know, you talk about these, the guardians, these entities. I don't know, have you heard about The Cosmic Serpent, a book by Jeremy Norby?
Yeah, I talk about that in my books also, yeah.
You do that? Oh, okay, because, I mean, he obviously states that there have been tribes in the past that have been, you know, extracting information on how to handle certain issues in our world. For instance, the sedative, I guess, that they developed in I don't know where, it's some tribe in Amazon, I guess. I mean, do you think that? I mean, do you have any idea about this? How is this possible to get information in that pretty clear way?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely, I mean, what's happened to me, you know, in these experiences has often been a kind of download of information or transmission of information that can be very clear and even in sort of, you know, our normal language.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it gives us a whole different way of thinking about what's going on. You know, I mean, I, the way I look at it now is that you know, the synthetic DMT is almost like too much and too fast for us at our stage of evolution.
Hmm.
So we need kind of like intermediaries, or maybe they're kind of like interfaces, like ayahuasca or iboga, or even the mushrooms. Are kind of like mediating this DMT reality and slowing down the images and the messages.
Oh.
That instead of like 10 minutes in this other reality, you have like 4 hours, or in the case of iboga, more like 15 or 20 hours, sort of in an in-between state where you're in between this reality and that reality.
Oh.
so it allows us actually to get to sort of get a deeper level of teaching.
Interesting. And I mean, I know that Terence McKenna theorized that basically that human civilization sprung up because of the use of mushrooms, I guess, and other things too. But I mean, is this something you would tend to agree with, or have any ideas about that?
I mean, I think it's an interesting thesis. I don't think that I have the scientific credentials to say yes or no.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's clearly that something sort of catalyzed the kind of human species to develop language and intelligence.
Yeah.
And it seems to have happened in a relatively quick period of time.
Yeah.
I talk in my book about Noam Chomsky, who notes that in terms of language development, there doesn't seem to be any way that it could have been incremental from animal communication to human communication.
Yeah.
It was more like a quantum shift into a higher level of complexity, a totally different kind of brain organization that language requires.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this may be, you know, what we're learning about how evolution works. There's a kind of slower period and a kind of build up, and then this kind of quantum leap. So is it possible that kind of quantum leap into language and rational thought was somehow catalyzed by use of psychedelics?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite possible.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Because I mean, that brings us to, to talk about Terence again. I know he had. Are you familiar with his time wave zero theory?
Yeah. Definitely, I talk about it in the new book.
You do that? Oh, okay.
Because
I mean, that really connects the. Allegedly, I heard that he did not know about the Mayan calendar and the end date of that when he proposed this theory but you know, they came to the same date basically, and that ties us in here with the Mayan calendar and the 2012 dates. I mean, do you think that this could be a sign of these of the next quantum leap or something similar to that will take us further now into awareness or beyond this reality? What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, that's basically the hypothesis that I'm developing in my new book in 2012.
Mm.
That everything is pointing towards this period ahead of us, leading to a kind of quantum shift in human consciousness to this next stage of evolution, and. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very, very interesting. I mean, Terence McKenna was in the Amazon in the early 70s with his brother, and, you know, they were eating a lot of mushrooms, and basically the mushroom began to speak to Terence.
Yeah,
and told
yeah.
him that it was a sort of aspect of a galactic intelligence or a galactic civilization that distributed itself around the universe on spores, on meteorites, and crashed into planets, and then waited until the sort of central nervous system of mammals reached a certain point of development and created a symbiotic partnership. And that's, uh-huh. that basically that's what it was doing with the human species. And at the same time, within the same week, while I was having this experience, the mushroom also explained that our whole model of time was incorrect. So we'd inherited this kind of Newtonian model, a very simple model of time being kind of linear and spatial, that every moment of time is the same as any other moment. Hmm. And that actually the mushroom proposed a kind of different model of time that was more kind of fractal or spiral.
Yeah.
And when McKenna left the jungle, he spent the next few years trying to kind of formalize this way of looking at time. And he ended up developing this time wave zero, which used the I Ching and turned it into a kind of, a sort of algorithm or something.
Yeah.
And, I think that the time wave is not very kind of effective as a mathematical model because McKenna is trying to sort of quantify novelty.
Yeah.
And really, what does novelty mean? I mean, it has no statistical validity, in a sense. I think that what's for me, like what I discuss in the book, is this kind of idea of I really look at the concepts from Carl Jung, from Jungian psychoanalysis, and the idea of sort of archetypes in the collective unconscious, but the archetypes actually have this kind of reality, this kind of legitimacy, and they kind of constellate over time, and eventually they seek to kind of come to presence in our historical reality.
Hmm.
So I would say that McKenna was involved in the return of this archetype, which is this kind of Mayan apocalypse, this uncovering of this knowledge system that leads to this next leap in consciousness. Since him, we have José Arguelles, John Major Jenkins, and then Carl Johan Kalaman, who've been kind of formalizing how this process takes place using the Mayan, the information from the Mayans, and that the Mayan civilization was really the highest development of Mesoamerican thought, and it was kind of like this kind of crystallization of a whole knowledge system where they were using ritual and psychedelics to download these transmissions about consciousness and astronomy and time. And I think they spent several hundred years really putting this carefully in place, and then once they had it, they kind of monumentalized it in their sculptures and in their temple friezes and so on.
Yeah.
And the idea that Arguelles puts forth is that they really did this to leave this information behind for us, so that we would kind of recover it and uncover it as we reach the end of the cycle.
Ah, interesting. And is this, you obviously are familiar with the name Quetzalcoatl, do you think that this is one of these, archetypes then? Have you chosen that name for that reason?
Yeah, exactly. Quetzalcoatl is an archetype. And as an archetype, it represents, the Quetzal is a bird, a sort of rainbow feathered bird, and Coatl is the serpent. So it represents the union of the bird and the snake, which is also the union of heaven and earth, or air and the physical, spirit and matter.
Yeah.
One other way I think about it in the book is it could be the integration of kind of the Western empirical scientific mindset with the kind of intuitive, mystical, shamanic way of knowing and being that the West has kind of suppressed in the last hundreds of years. So, and it's when these two forms of knowledge come back together that we create this new form of consciousness.
That's interesting because I guess that many people who aren't familiar with maybe shamanism and so forth think that we are, when you propose an idea like this, how should I say that we, should go? If I understand it correct, you don't say that we should, go back to shamanism, but this is about incorporating that idea, that spiritual idea, into our world, and then, take our world forward instead of backward. Is that correct?
Exactly correct. Yeah, no, I'm looking at something new, which is this new combination of the kind of technical efficiency, rational empirical consciousness of the modern West, with this kind of, you know, archaic, mystical, and shamanic way of relating to the universe, and that we can really see that they're not, you know, opposed to each other at all. They've been really coming together over the last century.
Yeah.
I mean, one way that that's very clear is if you study, like, quantum physics and Friedhof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, where he noted that, you know, what the quantum physicists what they came up with really supported and sort of mirrored a lot of these Eastern metaphysical concepts and ideas.
Yeah. Ah, interesting. And for, I mean, maybe we could talk a little bit about that. I mean, what to you, what is a shaman? What does that mean, that term even?
Well, the shaman is kind of the intercessor or intermediary between this reality and other planes of being. And serving that role, they act as a healer and a visionary, also the myth maker, the storyteller. I mean, the new age culture has almost sort of whitewashed the shaman a little bit and made them a little bit just these kind of benevolent figures.
Yeah.
But in actual practice, the shamans are often quite ambivalent or ambiguous. They often are sort of kept outside of the tribe because they're very powerful, and that power can be used to heal or to destroy.
Yeah.
So they're kind of liminal figures who sort of walk between the worlds. But they're necessary to kind of hold reality together, you know. This is what I really went through in Breaking Open the Head, was trying to understand, you know, what happened in the modern West in terms of our relationship to shamanism.
Yeah.
And how some of that function went into the kind of construct of the modern artist and modern art. But modern art doesn't have that kind of visceral, visionary aspect. And it also doesn't have that kind of healing component. I mean, it does in a kind of metaphorical way.
Mm.
But, you know, the shaman was definitely somebody who works with higher energies and sort of transduces these energies to kind of allow the human world to continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, how can we... I mean, I guess also then that the people today, it isn't about just, you know, taking drugs containing DMT and pretending you're a shaman. I mean, how do you feel that you can, you know, incorporate these ideas into the modern world, or is this very difficult? How does it work for you?
Well, it's happening, you know, right now with a lot of people that I know. I know people who are sort of recovering these kind of shamanic capacities and powers.
Mm.
And it seems to be moving very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, for myself, I don't really consider myself, you know, my archetype, I think, is more of the kind of wizard than the shaman.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I would say that I consider my books are almost like, you know, spell casting, you know, where you're trying to utilize a language in order to bring about, you know, a result.
Yeah.
But I do feel that this whole shamanic archetype is returning very powerfully into our contemporary world.
Mm.
In my first book, I talk about the 60s as a kind of attempted mass cultural voyage of shamanic initiation that kind of failed at that time because people would sort of go out into these other realities where there were no guides, there were no kind of wise men, there was no elder tradition to kind of help them navigate.
Yeah.
They would just kind of destroy themselves. So you have even people, you know, you have all the rock stars in the 60s, like, burning themselves out. And even somebody like John Lennon talking about how he took ego, LSD until he destroyed his own ego. It took him 10 years to get it back together.
Yeah.
So now I think we're going through a second stage process of this initiation, and it's happening in a much more grounded and foundational way because there are more people in place who've done that work. And there also is more connection to these indigenous cultures that are still holding these knowledge systems.
And I mean, 2012 is, I mean, who knows how big it's going to be when, I mean, the years ahead here, but it feels already that it is like an incredible movement and an entire, I mean, type of people who are behind this. And if nothing else, this, I guess, is the lead up to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, even if it's, you know, even if it's true or not, because at this point I guess that if everyone goes around and expects changes and of course starts to live accordingly and to implement these changes, then it will occur.
Right. Well, then on the other side of it, I mean, it's, you know, there are people who have nothing to do with the Mayan calendar, or haven't looked at this material at all, who are well aware that this is a very critical juncture. Like, basically, this is the most critical juncture that humanity has ever faced on this planet.
Mm.
I'm just reading this book today, I think by this guy Ernst Laszlo, called the Chaos Point or something.
Okay.
He doesn't mention the Mayan calendar. As far as I know, he has no concept of it. But he's talking about how the next 5 or 6 years are the critical point for the human species, and we're either going to, you know, break down or break through. And you know, from all the reading I've done in sort of the materialist kind of critics,
yeah.
That seems to be the case. I mean, if you look at, you know, the resource crisis, peak oil,
mm.
we've had this exponential increase in the human population. We had like 2 billion people in the 60s. Now we're up to like 6.5 billion.
Yeah.
We're really quickly shooting past the carrying capacity of the Earth. At the same time, we're experiencing massive species extinction to the point where in 25%, in 30 years, roughly 25% of all species may be extinct, especially mammalian species.
Mm.
And what we're also learning is that as that extinction goes forward, it's kind of, you know, that basically the whole web of life in the biosphere is very intermeshed. So if you knock out that many species, it could be really such a collapse of the whole biosphere. So that it really could lead to the extinction of the human species very easily.
Mm.
And in fact, there are different ecological groups and agencies who are now beginning to think that the human species does not have a great chance of living out this century.
Mm.
So when you look at all these things, so let's say that there's this 30-year window where there's going to be this 25% extinction of species. Well, if we want to make a kind of ecological U-turn and a sort of transformational shift in our practices, we're not going to be able to wait, you know, 10 years in which to do it. We're somehow going to have to be able to kick that into gear within the next, you know, five years.
Yeah.
So even if, you know, I mean, and then you think about the fact that the Mayans fixated on this year, 2012.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, from their vantage point, how could they have understood that humanity and so our global civilization would be in this critical juncture at this point in time?
Yeah.
And it seems that the way they understood it was through the downloads that came through the psychedelics and through astronomy, through a really precise understanding of the relationship between stellar bodies and the Earth, and how somehow what happens on Earth with human consciousness is somehow a kind of integrated or continuation of these larger cosmic cycles.
Yeah. Hmm. So, I mean, do you what do you think that we should expect here? I mean, in the coming years leading up to 2012, because from my point of view, I see that we have to have some kind of let me say it like this: this system as it is now in the Western world, I guess, must come to some kind of big bump in the road to, you know, to stop or to change its direction. I mean, I don't see it as going in any other way. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I think that's correct. I mean, the Kalman, Carl Kalman, wrote a book called The Mayan Calendar and the Transformation of Consciousness.
Yeah.
And he's the one who sort of most specifically figured out a kind of mathematical model for what's going on, and that there's this kind of exponential acceleration in the evolution of consciousness. So we're now going through, in 1 year, you know, in terms of the development of consciousness, novelty, new ideas, chaotic and catastrophic events, we're experiencing in 1 year what people were experiencing before 1999 in 20 years,
mm.
people were experiencing before 1755 in 400 years.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of telescoping taking place. And in this grid, there's like an energy flow of like light and dark or creative and destructive energies. So, I mean, for reasons that I think are pretty interesting, he ends up thinking that the year 2008 might be kind of like a critical threshold or kind of a civilizational collapse, maybe
yeah.
a global financial collapse. And I think that supports also what some of these peak oil theorists are saying and so on. So what we might see is that 2008 would be a kind of meltdown of the current socioeconomic structure.
Yeah.
And at that same time, the possibility to supersede that structure, to have in place a different kind of infrastructure that could support social transformation.
Yeah.
And I think that the internet may be very critical in this as a means to kind of put forward a whole new paradigm or infrastructure. I mean, we could see, like, you know, something like MySpace, which developed out of nothing, you know, now has well over 100 million people on it.
Yeah.
So something about the internet is pointing towards, like, new forms of social organization, new kinds of social networks, and could potentially create a whole kind of infrastructure for different kind of social organization.
Yeah.
And my hope it would be, and I think actually the logic of the situation kind of dictates, is that this wouldn't be a kind of catastrophic transition necessarily. It might be more like a set of supersession, where one order kind of gives way to a higher order, kind of like the Hopis talk about it as movement from one world to another world.
Yeah,
it might be sort of like a snake shedding its skin, and in fact that we have to hope that old skin remains in place and holds together as this kind of new skin. And these new levels of social organization kind of form underneath it.
Yeah. I mean, from my standpoint, I think that, and I tend to, you know, see it more, I guess, conspiratorial, because, like the peak oil issue, I mean, from my standpoint, I think that there are already a certain type of technology available that would allow us to, you know, make the old oil industry obsolete, basically. But somehow this technology isn't yet being utilized, and so we can use it. I mean, what's your take on that?
I think to a certain extent there are probably lots of technologies that are in different stages of development.
Yeah.
And I would say part of moving forward will be like bringing like real intelligence and sort of analytical awareness to bear on all these different possibilities. So we can really sort them out, because at the moment I feel there's a lot of stuff that I wish I could get clear knowledge on, but it's difficult because the information is just not a little bit obscured or not there the way it should be.
Indeed.
And I don't know. I mean, conspiracy is a complex thing. It's a very easy kind of road to go down. For me, it becomes a little bit of a kind of a waste of psychic energy.
Yeah.
In that you sort of keep yourself in this mode of anxiety and fearfulness.
Yeah.
And that becomes a kind of, when you sort of, I guess one thing that I really look deep into in the new book is, that if consciousness is kind of the fundamental reality rather than sort of matter.
Yeah.
As kind of carriers of consciousness, how we kind of use our consciousness, our intention, and our activity of consciousness is really sort of always bringing new possibilities into manifestation.
Yeah, right.
So if we're keeping our consciousness in this kind of fear, anxiety realm, then we're kind of almost magnetizing those possibilities.
Yeah.
There's this guy on the West Coast, Rob Brezhne, who's written a book called Pronoia, The Antidote to Paranoia. And, he talks about in this book how, it's easy to see everything is conspiring against you.
Yeah.
Or you can see that everything is conspiring for you.
For you, yeah.
And everything has conspired for you to, like, get in, be who you are now and have, like, the best possible experience,
Yeah.
So it's really a question of our outlook and how we take things.
Yeah, exactly. And if we are a part of this collective unconscious mind, I guess that if it isn't until more people are aware that basically this kind of technology do exist that we are able to implement it, because it is our collective manifestation or our collective conscious that do the manifestation. So that is maybe perhaps why we haven't seen the implementation of these technologies yet. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. I also feel that I think that we have to be very clear and sort of put technology in its proper place.
Yeah,
and that's something that I discussed in 2012 also, that we demonize technology and we also see it as a savior, and somehow we're still kind of like misusing it. We're kind of, it's like a lot of our shadow projections get enmeshed in our use of technology.
Yeah,
and um, so kind of solution, you know, being technology. I feel that the solution is really this, our shift in mindset. And once we make that shift, then all sorts of other possibilities open up.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're high tech or very, very primitive.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know, going back to, you know, the kind of techniques that Rudolf Steiner talked about in biodynamic agriculture and, you know, planting cow horns and they ship different phases of the moon, you know, or it's using, like, the latest, you know, technology and social networks. It you know, everything's going to be, you know, kind of available for us when we kind of shift into a different mindset and relationship to the world we've created.
Yeah.
You know? And another whole aspect of this change for me is it would be like the idea that this kind of domain of the psyche or of psychic energy or psychic potential or power is somehow becoming more available. And in the book, I talk about the metaphor of electricity. That in the, you know, 1750s, you know, people had experienced lightning and seen that it could cause shocks and blow up trees and so on.
Yeah.
But nobody had the idea that you could somehow take electricity and make it into something transformative for the whole planet.
Yeah.
And so once they were able to do that, in a century and a half, we really transformed the whole surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
And it was just not an idea that anybody had before it happened, you know, in the 1750s. Nobody could have foreseen the way that would have happened and how fast it took place. So I think that we might be on a similar transition with psychic energy or psychic power, that more and more people are becoming conscious or aware of synchronicities, telepathy, you know, even like telekinesis, like things moving around, like things changing, you know, the ability of the mind to kind of manifest on all these different levels.
Yeah.
And there might be a transition point where that power becomes within our mastery, within our ability to consciously master it.
Yeah, and I mean, if we think back to the changes that have occurred now in the last 100 years, I mean, it's an amazing progress, and it has gone so fast. If we look at it, it's amazing, but it feels like, you know, right now we are right at the edge here, where things are beginning to almost, it moves so fast, but in a sense we are kind of locked in our you know, thinking and our ability to adjust to the new things that become available to us. And I mean, do you think that, I know that you talked earlier about this in your previous talks about the apocalypse, what that is and what it means and all that. I mean, maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit. Are we in that period now, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, my hypothesis is that we are in the apocalypse. And the apocalypse would be, you know, an archetype that has been sort of constellating in the West, in the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition over thousands of years.
Yeah.
And there, you know, have sort of been attempts in the past to kind of constellate it, but this is really when it's happening. And this is also what some of Carl Jung's followers say. Like Edinger wrote a book called Archetype of the Apocalypse, and he called the apocalypse this kind of momentous event of the coming of the self into conscious realization. And you know, Jung had this kind of split between the ego, which is our kind of individuated sense of ourselves, and the self, which was kind of this higher aspect of our reality, which contained both conscious and unconscious elements, and that somehow the self was kind of seeking to, sort of come to existence or incarnate in the individual ego.
Yeah.
And the ego was really resistant to that process because the sort of higher self just had different aims and intentions. So Christ was the kind of, for Jung, was kind of the archetype of the self incarnating an individual ego. And suddenly that individual, you know, Jesus, is no longer operating like everybody else in terms of, you know, fighting for their family and trying to get the best job and stay away from the tax collectors and so on.
Yeah.
It's more like that individual is now working from this transcendent dimension.
Yeah.
And really sort of uniting heaven and earth through their actions. So the apocalypse would be this period where this sort of self is coming, this higher self is coming and sort of making itself known through the individual. And the word apocalypse, it itself is not so much destruction. Apparently, it literally means uncovering or revealing.
Yeah.
So it's this period where things become more and more revealed. And so I think that's like a really amazing concept. Because then if you think about, like, if you have, you know, beautiful things within you and you know, create, you know, poetic things, and, you know, you're, the more and more beauty and more poetry is going to be revealed. If you're a stinker, you know, more and more stinky stuff is going to be revealed. You know? And it really does feel like that's kind of going on right now, I think, you know.
that's interesting. Do you think that there will be a dramatic change let's do this before maybe, because I know that there are, you know, different theories when the Mayan calendar actually ends. Do you know about this?
Oh yeah.
Is it anyone that you favor? Is this important, do you think?
Yeah, I don't find it very important personally. I mean, I think what's important is to get this whole new paradigm. And then you really have to, like, you know, move into it in a way and integrate it, and that takes some work.
Mm.
And then, like, you know, I don't see, like, this end date, whether it's December 21st, 2012, or whatever it is, as mattering. It's more like recognizing that we're in this, like, short space of time where we have, like, a lot of work to do on ourselves and sort of transformative work on a planetary level, and making that commitment. So that we could really feel like, you know, we're headed in the right direction, and you know, I think it's gonna, if my paradigm is accurate at all, at some point, reality will become very, very different. But I have to say that in my world, reality has already become very, very different.
Yeah.
I mean, I live in a, you know, I didn't live in a synchronic order before, and now I do. You know, I didn't live in a telepathic reality before, and now I do. So I experience on a day-to-day level a sort of deepening and intensifying of this whole way of being and knowing. It often blows my mind if I think about who I was 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I find that a lot of my friends are also experiencing. It's just this incredibly accelerated sense of self-transformation.
So
to me, it's ongoing. And it's like, you know, even if the world was to end next week, you know, we have to have a nuclear war and everything got blown to smithereens, you know, I would still feel that, you know, I've accomplished, like, a huge amount in this particular life.
And I
could face that ending, you know, pretty calmly, I think, you know.
Yeah. do you think that, I mean, for those people who might never, you know, become aware, because this is, I mean, still this is not mainstream information in any sense, and it is only for the explorers and those who really, you know, bother to search for it, I guess. But I mean, for all those people who might not be aware of it, and but still are affected by these changes, I mean, do you think that it will be like a very, very dramatic time now in the years here leading up to 2012?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know what it's like in you're in Sweden, right?
That's right.
I mean, in the U.S., you know, I think that the normal, like, the ordinary citizens are already being kind of buffeted and squeezed like you know, dried out lemons or something. You know, for every last drop. I mean, they're hugely in debt. You know, they're working these endless hours.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of trapped in the pincers of this kind of insane mechanism.
So
hopefully this shift will mean alleviation of suffering for a lot of people on the planet. Because at the moment we are not utilizing our resources correctly, and we are not creating a kind of compassionate global civilization.
No, of course.
It's stupid, basically. I mean, in my new book, 2012, I talk about Herbert Marcuse, who's this Frankfurt School philosopher, and he noted that, you know, post the Second World War, you know, we should have created a global leisure society. I mean, industrialization should have alleviated most of the need for work.
Yeah.
But instead, the kind of control apparatus of the governments, the corporations, instituted this maniacal work culture, and it's accelerated the destruction of the planet, because most of the work that most of the people are doing, perhaps as much as 98% of it, is just garbage.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, people are driving their cars to offices where they're using toner cartridges and you know, et cetera, et cetera,
yeah.
You know, paper and so on, and it's just like, You know, for what? You know,
yeah.
it has no, you know, sort of benefit to the planetary ecology. It's just taking away.
Yeah.
So the whole thrust of what we're doing as a species has to be examined and then shifted into a different kind of track.
Hmm.
And I think this could happen very, very suddenly. There's going to be a kind of crisis and then the dawning of awareness. And, you know, as I said, we have these kind of models of kind of quantum shifts in consciousness. And also
yeah.
the way consciousness seems to happen is that a small group of people sort of develop a new paradigm or a new way of being, and then that can transmit, once they've kind of crystallized it, that can transmit across the whole planet very, very quickly.
The 100th monkey.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a kind of personal relationship to that kind of idea because my mother was in the Beat Generation, was involved with Jack Kerouac when On the Road came out.
Mm.
And, you know, there, up until that point in 57, there had just been like a few hundred Beats kind of crisscrossing the country. Nobody cared about them.
Mm.
You know, they were sort of just doing their thing. And then suddenly they came into the spotlight, and between 57 and maybe like 65, you know, they gave birth to Bob Dylan and the Beatles and this huge global hippie movement,
yeah.
which, you know, so some 200 Beats in 57, you had, you know, who knows how many hippies, you know, 20
yeah.
million or something by the mid to late 60s. And now we're in an even much more accelerated phase in terms of how our global communications meshes all together.
Mm.
So a shift in consciousness could transmit to a very large scale in a very rapid period.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think that the new hippie movement, so to speak, are the crowds, you know, that are at festivals like Burning Man and Boom Festival? Like you, I guess you were on that festival now in Portugal, right?
Yeah, that was a beautiful one. Yeah.
Hmm. Do you think that? I mean, I never been there, but I mean, is it this kind of culture? I mean, that is how should I say talked about here, or do you get the sense that there is this kind of awareness at these festivals?
I think the awareness is now growing quickly.
Mm.
For a long time, in these kind of festival culture, there was a kind of the desire was so great just to kind of tune out of the mainstream culture
yeah.
and not think. You know, I think one problem with the hippie culture, but it's a sort of natural reaction to the kind of academic sort of institutions and corporate institutions that people are coming out of, is, you know, people really didn't want to like be sort of intellectually challenged, in a sense, when they went into this kind of festival world.
Hmm.
They wanted to escape from the academy and the kind of, you know, the sense of just this kind of onslaught of knowledge that really wasn't, you know, helpful or useful.
Yeah.
But so you know, I feel that myself and a bunch of other people who are now presenting at these festivals, it's like a kind of new integrated paradigm that's coming together.
Hmm.
And I think people are definitely responding to it, you know.
Hmm.
So to me, it's like a natural process, you know. In every level, I really see that we're in this, you know, process of the evolution of consciousness on the planet, and it's very much like a natural process. It's like fetal development, and it's very precise. And in a sense, we're now in kind of like the birth canal.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I think that the crowd of these festivals is one, you know, one component. You
yeah.
know, I think there are a lot of people who went through the 60s and previous countercultural eras who have a kind of vestigial memory of what it's like to be in that kind of transformational space.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there are people from all sorts of traditions who are going to come at it from other angles, whether they're Sufi or Buddhist or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be multi, you know, sort of a multi-tiered process.
Hmm.
You know?
And from my standpoint, I think that the movements in some sense almost was towards the end co-opted and I think that much of the good ideas that were developed within that movement kind of disappeared into a haze of drugs, basically. And I don't know, is this something that we should be worried about happening again? Do you agree with that?
Sure. I mean, I don't know if worried is the right word. Hopefully we're wiser. You know, hopefully having gone through that previous process and its dissolution,
yeah.
there's a kind of preserved imprint, you know, of memory that will help us navigate the situation in a better way this time.
Mm.
I think in the U.S., I think that, you know, especially in the counterculture, there's now a growing, a much deeper sophistication about substances.
Mm.
I sort of hate to call certain psychedelics drugs, because I feel it's very trivializing.
Yeah, of course.
And I feel with ayahuasca or peyote or mushrooms, you really need a different kind of language.
Mm.
Or maybe you talk about them as medicines or sacraments or something.
Yeah.
And that language itself kind of creates reality in a sense. So as long as we're like stuck in certain constructs, it sort of stops us from revisioning what's going on.
Yeah.
I think we can separate out kind of pursuit of non-ordinary states of consciousness, altered states of consciousness. That's really meaningful and profound and helpful and healing from stuff that's more just useless.
You know? We got about 3.5 minutes left here, but I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your books and how to get them and so forth?
Right on. Yeah. So the books are available certainly from Amazon in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's probably the best way for people in Europe to get them at the moment. The Breaking Open the Head was also available from England, so it'll be out on Amazon UK, and it'll 2012 will be coming out in England in February from Piatkis Press.
Yeah.
But the American edition of the hardcover, I think, is a very beautiful book to have. I'm very happy with the way they produced it and the cover and everything. So I think people will enjoy having that edition.
Yeah. What are you doing now? Are you just traveling, giving talks, or are you planning?
I'm actually going to the Burning Man Festival in 1 week. At the moment, I'm awaiting with some anxiety Rolling Stone magazine, because it's coming out on Thursday, and it has a 5-page feature on me.
Ah, there we go.
So that'll be very interesting to see what they've done with all the stuff that I was yakking about.
Interesting. And to finish off, we have about 2 minutes, but let's say this. I mean, we're at the year 2013 now. what kind of world do you think that we're living in?
Well, I think we may go into a world that's very. I really like the idea that the imagination becomes kind of our kind of home base in a way.
Yeah.
And that we're in a world that is corresponding to our imagination to a much deeper degree. And I think it's quite possible that we'll be communicating in sort of intentionally with other forms of consciousness. Some of them otherworldly entities such as elves and goblins and whatever name we give them at that point. I think we're just going to reach a whole other level of sophistication about kind of other dimensional consciousnesses, perhaps extraterrestrial entities. I mean, I think that the crop circles deserve to be taken seriously when you overlook the whole phenomenon as some kind of communication from a higher intelligence or galactic intelligence that's sort of frantically sending us signals that we have something really, really great to look forward to as we go through this transition.
Mm. I think that's a beautiful place to end the interview.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much for coming on, Daniel. This has been great. And I mean, let's stay in contact. I mean, we can do it again sometime down the road here. So
anytime, I'm here for you.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Okay, cool.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.